We are talking once again with Jav Perish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So, multiple election-related developments this week.
This week, State Senator Joe Wynn has announced that he'll run against Dow Constantine for King County Executive this year. Candidate filing in King County starts on May 17th and then closes 5 days later on May 21st. So in a couple weeks, we're going to find out if there are any other candidates who are going to jump into that race. It's interesting that Joe Wynn, who's only served, I believe, a couple of years in the state Senate, is already...
He was elected in 2018, yeah.
Yeah, he's already looking to move to a different position now. He's very popular in South King County in particular. So he has a real chance of unseating Dow Constantine.
I'm going to respectfully disagree. He has zero chance, and he probably knows it. That's not any knock on him. I like Joe Wynn a lot. I think he's done a really good job in Olympia, and he's much more progressive than Constantine.
Oh, yes.
But Constantine has already wrapped up all the endorsements. He's already wrapped up all the major donors. Wynn is getting into this race very late for anybody who's making a serious run at it. And the politicos I've talked to can't figure out why he's running for this particular seat. The consensus seems to be that it's a practice run, and he'll, you know, make a more serious effort at it when Constantine retires or in 4 years or whenever. But this is just for name recognition.
Okay.
for a countywide race, because it's very hard to win countywide. You have to have a lot of money in order to do it. And Wynn just doesn't have access to that kind of money right now because it's so late in the race. And Constantine's already sucked most of it up. So,
we'll see. I'm kind of wondering, you know, if maybe he doesn't have some backers behind him who urged him to jump in.
He probably does. Yeah. And as you say, he's popular in South County and West Seattle. And obviously he'd have the immigrant community behind him.
Uh-huh.
But,
and
you know,
I see that as the main reason why he would get into the race is because he feels, and a lot of people of color in King County feel, that Constantine has not been responsive enough to their concerns on oversight for the King County Sheriff's Department, and particularly on the youth jail.
Yeah, although Constantine did announce last year a plan to eliminate the youth jail.
He did, but
yeah,
he's phasing it
in. Due to pressure from the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Well, the neighborhoods, and then it was negotiated for over a number of months with BLM Seattle King County. Mm-hmm. That was going on behind the scenes for a long time. But, and that's really going to be up to King County Council to implement. Constantine doesn't entirely control that process at all. Similar to how Seattle City Council is really the lead agency for defunding SPD. But yeah, I think
just like here in Seattle, the city council writes the budget, but then it's up to the mayor to actually spend the funds. I think that's also the case in King County. And one of the other issues that folks have been hitting Constantine for is building a new jail. So there's that issue as well.
Yeah. I think Wynn will likely get 30-40% of the vote, which is pretty respectable considering against an incumbent. But I don't see where the additional margin is going to come from. And,
yeah,
you know, I hope I'm wrong.
Well, we'll
I like
see.
Him a lot, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I also this week wanted to take a look, because it's been a few weeks, at, how the leading, candidates are doing in terms of raising money in the big three races here inside the city of Seattle, the mayor's race and the two city council seats, particularly the mayor's race, since there are multiple, candidates in that race who are raising big dollars. And, I also wanted to take a quick look at, who has the most democracy vouchers and which districts are behind them. So, number one in the race for mayor is Colleen Echohawk, who has $284,182 in her campaign fund, 72% of which are from democracy vouchers. That's a really high percentage. 80% of her contributions are under $200. And I chose the $200 threshold because you get $100 in democracy vouchers. And the way the Seattle Ethics and Election breaks out how they classify contributions, there's the category 0 to 100, 0 to 99, 100 to 199, 200 to 299, et cetera, up to their top. The maximum, which is 600, so it's 500 to 599 is the top amount. And so I'm looking at I use $200 because people can send all $100 of their democracy vouchers to a candidate, and then they'd fall in that $100 to $199 category. So I chose $200 as the break. So 80% of her contributions are under that $200 break. Her contributions are very evenly spread throughout Seattle's seven districts, and only 9% from outside Seattle. And that's one of the lowest percentages of any candidate in any of the three races, which I found very interesting. And if you think about an all-city race, that a candidate to really win in a race that accepts votes from residents of all the districts in the city of Seattle, you'd want to see this. You'd want to see a very widespread in their financial support from all over the city. So when you look at it as a pie chart, you want to see all the slices are pretty even. And that's what we're seeing with Colleen Echohawk's supporters. So she is probably the most viable candidate right now. But closing in on her is the number two candidate, and that's Lorena Gonzalez, who has $174,132 in her fund. She's about $110 behind Echohawk. Of course, Echohawk got into the race earlier. Yeah, $110,000. Echohawk got into the race a lot earlier than Gonzalez, and Gonzalez is playing catch up on this. But also, let's look a little bit at her contributions. 57% are from democracy vouchers, so she's playing catch up there as well. 69% of her contributions, still a pretty respectable amount, are under $200. Her contributions are also pretty evenly spread throughout the seven districts, but then 17% are from outside Seattle. And I think I talked in the past how she's got a lot of support from other attorneys, not all of whom are in Seattle, because she has a legal career behind her. And that outside Seattle segment is the second largest source of her contributions, behind District 3, which makes up 18%. So Gonzalez is playing catch up. She's got a ways to go yet, but she's probably the second most viable candidate. But then not too far behind those top two is Andrew Grant Houston. He made headlines this week because he has the most in total in dollar terms of democracy vouchers of any candidate in any of the city races right now. He's raised $137,308. 82% of his contributions are under $200. So that really tells you that he's going hard for the democracy vouchers, and he's going after small dollar contributions. His contributions are mostly from District 2 and District 3. The two together make up 40% of his contributions, with a range of about 8% to 11% from most of the other districts. And 14% of his are from outside Seattle. So he's running as the progressive in the race. So he's trying to make up his campaign contributions from very small dollar contributors, and it's putting him in play. And so we'll see how he does in the primaries. But I think he's got kind of a, he's got a high bar there to clear with Echo Hawk having so much funding behind her and Gonzalez having so much name recognition. And then there's Bruce Harrell, who jumped into the race late and has raised already $105,542, pretty respectable. He has no democracy voucher info listed yet, although I'm pretty sure he's probably got them because he's qualified to collect them. But when you start looking at the breakout, I can see why he hasn't really listed that many. Only 21% of his contributions are under $200. The largest group, 39%, is at the maximum contribution level of $500 to $599. His largest geographical group is outside the city limits at 34% of his contributors. That's more than a third of his contributors are from outside the city. And the next largest group is from District 7, downtown. So pretty clearly he's milking the Downtown Business Association and, business owners for his, for support. And then, of course, his second, his next largest group is from District 2, and that's where his old council seat was, with about 13% of his contributions from there. Now, in fifth place is Jessen Farrell, and she's lagging way behind with $53,545 in contributions. 74% are from democracy vouchers. That's the highest percentage, other than Colleen Echo Hawk and Andrew Grant Houston in the race. Only 36%, however, of her contributions are under $200, which means people are giving her all their democracy vouchers and then some. So I'm guessing wealthier folks are giving her their democracy vouchers and then also including a check for a higher amount in that envelope. Yeah.
Her old state legislative seat is Laurelhurst in that area, so it's a fairly wealthy constituency that's most familiar with her.
Yeah, and her largest two groups are the maximum of $500 to $599 contributions, which is totals about one quarter of her donations, and the $400 to $499 level, which is about 21%. So together, that's almost half of her contributions. Contributions by district shows that 28% of her donations are from outside the city limits, one of the highest in the race. Then District 3 and 4 have 18% and 17% respectively, which again, Job, you're right. That's, you know, places like Laurelhurst, places like Madrona Park, places where very, very wealthy people live along the shore of Lake Washington. In the other district, she has much smaller amounts from there. So Farrell is also going for the wealthier white constituency, whereas Bruce Harrell is going for the wealthy, the pro-business, and the person of color who has substantial resources. Lance Randall, the community developer, real estate developer, has about $34,588. His contributions are only trickling in. He has no democracy vouchers yet, even though he was the first person among these candidates to declare he was running. The vast majority of his contributions are over $500, 52%, and only 26% is under $200. His biggest source is from outside Seattle, with 27% of his contributions from there. And then District 3, he's got a full quarter of his contributions from District 3. And then District 4, 16%, with the others much, much smaller. So he's kind of the niche candidate at this point. So what this analysis shows is that in the mayor's race, the two big candidates so far are Colleen Echo Hawk and Lorena Gonzalez, with Andrew Grant Houston doing his best to catch up as the progressive alternative. And then Bruce Harrell and Jessen Farrell kind of battling it out over who's going to represent the business, the sort of white wealthy business class in the city. In the Council District 9 race, we have I think the last time I looked at this, Sarah Nelson was the leader. But right now, Nikita Oliver is the leader in terms of fundraising. She's raised $116,944. 35%, well over a third, are from democracy vouchers. 73% of her contributions are under $200, which is pretty amazing. That's nearly three quarters of her contributions. Support for her is coming mostly from three districts. District 3, where she's got 24% of her contributions. District 2, 16% of contributions are from there. And District 6 with 14%. Excuse me. The rest of the districts, she's gotten maybe 7 to 10% of her contributions from, and only 10% of her support is from outside Seattle. So typically, like I said, you want to look at this in terms of a pie chart where all the pie slices are pretty equal by district. If a candidate, I think that will really predict that a candidate's got broad support. Nikita Oliver isn't quite there yet, but she's getting closer.
I would also wager the thing about the districts is that it doesn't really tell you where the support is coming from.
It doesn't.
You really need to look at the precinct by precinct, because that will tell you how much of it, for instance, is coming from wealthy neighborhoods near the water, versus less wealthy neighborhoods inland.
Which is why I was looking at dollar amount of contributions.
Sure.
Because I think that's a good quick way to tell.
Yeah, and again, if you're getting mostly small contributions, that's a sign of a grassroots campaign. It's also a sign of a campaign that doesn't necessarily have broad appeal. I wonder about Oliver's base of support and how broad that is.
Well, we'll find out. I think it's good that she's getting some support from these other districts. I think that she probably has some work to do, and that the pandemic lockdown is not helping grassroots candidates that much. We're seeing Andrew Grant Houston. If you look at his district breakout too, the pie slices are not even. And I think definitely the pandemic lockdown is making it hard to do doorbelling, making it hard to do get-togethers, small fundraisers in people's houses, the kind of things that grassroots candidates really rely on to give them a boost.
And most of the summer festivals aren't going to happen this year either.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Yeah, it seems unlikely.
Seems unlikely at this point.
Yeah.
Now, so. Number two in that race, District 9, all citywide council race, is Sarah Nelson. She's gotten $91,148, and she is not taking democracy vouchers at all, so that she can get big, big donations. 78% of her contributions are over $200, of course, and 54% are at the maximum of $500 to $599 or higher.
Wow.
Yeah. Most of her support comes from four districts, and those are District 7, which is downtown Queen Anne, Magnolia, which makes up 20%. District 3, which makes up 19%. Again, those wealthy enclaves along the water, Lake Washington. District 6, from which she has 15%. That's one of what we're finding out to be one of the most conservative districts in Seattle.
It's also where she lives.
Yes. And District 4, which again is north of the Ship Canal with those wealthy folks living in Magnolia, et cetera, living in Laurelhurst and areas along Lake Washington, giving heavily to her. And about 14% is from outside the city limits. So clearly Sarah Nelson is going after the rich white pro-business folks. And then third in that race is Brianna Thomas, who looked initially like she might be a good middle choice for folks who didn't want to go with a conservative Sarah Nelson or the very progressive Nikita Oliver, but she's trailing very badly in fundraising. Thomas only has $30,692, and I think she's fallen far far too far behind to catch up. So I didn't even really look at the breakdown of her contributions.
Particularly because she doesn't have a lot of name recognition. And when you're running citywide, and you don't have name recognition, you have to fundraise because you can't doorbell the whole city. You just can't.
It helps to have several organizations behind you endorsing you, like labor groups and, you know, community groups and so forth, because they have those email lists and they have those contacts they can call up and they can do fundraising on your behalf. Nikita Oliver is taking advantage of a lot of community groups to help her out. I'm sure Sarah Nelson is taking advantage of business groups Bruce Harrell in the mayor's race is probably taking advantage of business groups. I imagine Justin Farrell is working the Democratic committees, you know, the district Democratic committees and so forth. You know, that's how you do it. And I don't think Brianna Thomas has those contacts. Now, in Council District 8, Teresa Mosqueda is really the only viable candidate in that race, and the only one who's raised any real money so far. She has $119,945 behind her, but her contributions are still 59% from democracy vouchers. Shows you how much passion people have for supporting her, even when she doesn't have any real challengers. 77% of her contributions are under $200. And she's also got a mostly even spread of support from all seven districts. Her pie chart looks like it has some pretty even slices in it, with District 3, of course, being her biggest one, with 20% of her contributions from there, and District 5, her smallest one, with 9%. District 5 is the District North, which is Deborah Juarez's city council district. It's like Lake City and very far north in Seattle. And she only has, Mosqueda only has about 10% of her contributions from outside Seattle. So again, she looks like it would be really tough for somebody to jump into that race and beat her, I think, which is why she hasn't drawn any challengers.
Yeah, but we've got three more weeks until filing deadline, and I think in particularly in the mayor's race, we're likely to get one more major candidate.
You think so, huh?
I do.
I think it's kind of late at this point. They would have to go into
I think it is likely to be Tim Burgess or somebody like that who can raise a lot of money from the business community. The pro-business candidates are not particularly strong in the mayor's race. You know, Harrell is beatable. You know, Justin Farrell is beatable. You know, they're not the leading candidates right now. And, I think you've got some people in the business community who want a stronger candidate to represent their interests.
Yeah, I think that's true. On the other hand, I think there are plenty of, businesses who are viewing Colleen Echohawk as someone who is friendly to their agenda. So that also may be why she has garnered so much support, and is, running about $110,000 ahead of Lorena Gonzalez. So,
Which is really remarkable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Echohawk, can kind of have that both ways, because she has the service provider background, she's a woman of color, and yet she, you know, has a favorable rep in the business community. And, you know,
she's worked with a lot of folks who have business backgrounds. So
you can say that, you know, she's trying to have it both ways, but you know what? That's also what successful campaigns do.
Yeah.
So she's looking pretty good right now.
Yeah, and you know, that was kind of, I think, one of the ways that the business community viewed Jenny Durkin. You know, she was a woman, she's a lesbian, but she was someone very pro-business, very kind of business-friendly, and so they threw a lot of support behind her, and I think they're probably viewing Colleen Echohawk in those terms as well.
Yeah.
So.
But one of the unique things of the business community is they have the resources to be able to fund multiple candidates
if they want.
Very short notice.
Yeah, that's very true.
That's true. So we'll see.
Yep.
Mid-May is when the
it's going to start to get interesting real soon.
Yeah, we'll see. So, Okay, so let's talk for a minute about the lawsuit that was filed this week against the state's new capital gains tax. This week, on Wednesday, the conservative group the Freedom Foundation filed a lawsuit in Douglas County Superior Court against the state's new capital gains tax. That was Senate Bill 5096, which the governor signed.
And Douglas County is one of the most rural counties in Washington. It's where Waterville is. It's between Wenatchee and Spokane.
Mm-hmm. Very conservative district.
Very conservative district. So they're judge shopping.
Yeah. The state constitution has two provisions that the Freedom Foundation say are applicable to this case. One is the provision that prohibits income taxes. And the second is the 1933 state Supreme Court ruling that declared all income in Washington state a form of property. The state constitution requires that all property taxes be levied equally in Washington state. Even though the bill uses the language excise tax throughout it, and describes the capital gains tax as an excise tax, the Freedom Foundation says that a capital gains tax is clearly an income tax. And I would say that certainly the federal government thinks that capital gains are income. So it will be up to the Washington State Supreme Court to decide whether that's true here in Washington State. I would say that that's the strongest part of the Freedom Foundation's case. Because Senate Bill 5096 exempts capital gains under $250,000, the Freedom Foundation also says that the new tax would discriminate against rich people by forcing them to pay a tax that middle class and poor people won't have to pay. So, if the Washington State Supreme Court agrees that a capital gains tax is an income tax, this provision would also mean that that the capital gains tax violates the state constitutional requirement that all property taxes be levied equally. Now,
I'm wondering if that's a double-edged, if the suit is a double-edged sword, in that, you know, what if the Supreme Court decides that this is a good opportunity to overturn that 1933 ruling?
Yeah.
Which is what people have been after for a long time.
Yeah. And so that's one of the issues here. But there's a third argument that the Freedom Foundation is making against the tax. It would also apply to the sale of assets held outside of Washington state if the owner lives within Washington state. The Freedom Foundation claims that this is a violation of the Commerce Clause of the United States. So they're looking to the U.S. Constitution, not to the state constitution in that case. Although I have to say that's probably the weakest part of their argument, because the bill SB 5096 allows you to offset the Washington tax owed on the sale of out-of-state assets if you end up paying taxes in another state on that sale. So that's really how a lot of other states' tax systems work. And given that there are only about half a dozen other states with no income taxes at all, this could make this third argument moot. So, and of course, the Republicans recognize that there's always the risk that bringing a lawsuit against the capital gains tax may allow our more progressive Washington State Supreme Court to overturn some prior court rulings. That's certainly a risk. However, I think they feel they have a pretty strong case that because the federal government and other states tax capital gains as income, that the Democrats in the legislature can't get around that just by swapping in the term excise tax. I think it's a pretty strong case, but we'll see. And I think the way to get around all this, of course, is if the state legislature could repeal, that's probably not going to happen because it would require a prohibitively high majority of legislators to vote to repeal that portion of the state constitution, or if voters were to vote in heavy numbers to do the same. And I think that's also a very heavy lift.
Well,
so we'll see. We'll see what happens. Certainly, the Democrats expected a lawsuit, and they're saying, bring it on. We're ready to fight. So we'll see.
Any sense for when that will take place?
Well,
You
know, the courts move at their own speed. So we'll see. Certainly the Democrats can ask for the state Supreme Court for the Superior Court in Douglas County to expedite its ruling, and then they can ask the state Supreme Court to take it, the state Supreme Court to take it up and rule quickly, but the states move in their own time.
Yeah. For sure. Speaking of which.
Speaking of the state, I want to do my rundown of some of what I thought were the important bills that passed this year. Of course, there's the new 2-year state budget, operating budget. That was Senate Bill 5092, which passed finally, at the very end of the session last Sunday. It has about $59 billion in total in the general fund. That's $5 billion higher than the last 2-year budget. Plus, when you add in federal grants and dedicated funding sources, an example would be Medicaid, for example, the total state budget comes to about $122.6 billion this year once you add in all those dedicated funding sources, which are allocated to specific expenses. Now, some of the biggest departments in the state budget, to give you an idea, is public schools, K through 12. That's by far the biggest single department. And it gets a combination of funding from both the general fund and from the federal government that comes up to $33.25 billion. Washington State Healthcare Authority has $24.6 billion from all of its different sources. The Department of Social and Health Services comes in at number 3 with $16.6 billion. Department of Children, Youth, and Families gets about $4 billion. And community and technical colleges will get $3.9 billion this year from all sources. And the Department of Health, $2.9 billion from all sources. Those are just some of the biggest departments in the state budget. There are many other departments in the state government, including the Department of Commerce, the Department of Corrections, the Employment Security Department, which takes in and pays out state unemployment. The Department of Labor and Industries, which does the same with workers' compensation when workers are injured on the job, the State Lottery Commission, the Department of Natural Resources, the Departments of Ecology and Fish and Wildlife, the Office of the State Attorney General, the state courts, the state parks, the Washington State Patrol, and on and on. The state government funds a lot of things in the state of Washington, but it all kind of boils down to four principal categories: schools, human services, natural resources, and the functions of state government, which includes cops, courts, jails, the legislature, the governor's office, and the other departments that run the state government, like the attorney general's office, the Department of Commerce, et cetera. So those four big, if you think in those four big categories, then you can kind of easily categorize state expenditures. Schools are the big one. Human services are another big one. Natural resources are the third big piece of the pie. And then, you know, the functions of state government, the Department of Licensing, it's the Department of Corrections, et cetera. Now, some of the departments that got a big increase this year include public schools for K through 12 students will receive an additional $4.1 billion, including $1.7 billion to reopen and help students catch up from their lost year of trying to learn from home. I think that was the top priority of the state legislature this year. Community and technical colleges will get $2.3 billion in additional funding, and that will more than double the state's funding to community colleges and technical schools. And that really aligns with President Biden's plan to eventually offer 2 years of free community technical college training to students. So really moving towards that idea that if you want to get a decent job now, you really need K through 12 plus 2 education in order to get a decent job in today's world. Now, another department that will get a lot of extra funding in this budget is the Department of Social and Health Services, which is going to see a $2.8 billion increase in funding, some from state funding, some from federal funding. And then the Washington State Healthcare Authority will get an extra $2.9 billion. Now, some of the increases will pay for things like additional child care programs, again, aligning with President Biden's move towards trying to provide low-cost, high-quality child care for all Americans, not just lower-income Americans, but even wealthier Americans, as just one of those things that the government should do for Americans. And I don't know how you can disagree with that, but Republicans are trying to find a way. Some of the other increases that the state budget will pay for includes money for the state's mental health care system, which has been in shambles for a long time, funding to expand the state's public health care system, which again has been in shambles for a while, and additional money for the state's health benefit exchange so that more people can afford insurance coverage on the state exchange. COVID-19 funds for public health. A lot of this is federal money to pay for vaccinations, testing, contact tracing, and recruiting more public health care workers to do those things. And, of course, additional equity and diversity initiatives. There's also money for wildfire response and the new sales tax rebate for low-income families, funding that for the first time. The working families tax exemption was passed by the state legislature a while ago, but there's never been enough money in the state budget to actually fund that. It would provide up to $1,200 in cash rebates for 420,000 low-income families and individuals in the form of a sales tax cash rebate to those folks each year. So that was it was really nice to see that funded for the first time in the state budget. So in addition, there are a couple of great bills that passed in the state legislature this year to tackle global warming. One is Senate Bill 5126 to institute a cap and trade system. Again, not a carbon tax, but a cap and trade system that is, I think, meant to be similar to California's cap and trade system, starting January 1st, 2023, to be set up and run by the State Department of Ecology. Businesses that emit greenhouse gases will be issued credits, which can be bought and sold. The total amount of credits in the state will decrease each year until emissions reach net zero over time. House Bill 1091 is the other bill that will require cleaner fuels for cars and trucks. But there's a big catch to these two bills. Conservative Democrats only voted for them with the understanding that they won't go into effect until the legislature passes an increase in the gas tax of at least 5%, or 5 cents. That's and that's always part of the big multi-year transportation bill, which didn't get passed this year. The transportation bill can take many years for the state legislature to refine and finally pass, but the Democrats have committed to hammering out their differences over the summer and fall months, and they say they'll have a bill ready for the next legislative session early next year. So these two bills were passed with the understanding that they'll only go into effect if the Democrats get on the ball and pass a transportation bill next year that includes a 5 cent increase in the gas tax. We'll see.
And if they pass that, I'm sure there will be a referendum on it.
Yeah, so we'll see.
The gas taxes are never popular.
No, they're never popular. So we'll see how that goes. Now, some of the other good bills that did pass, there are at least 9 bills that have already been signed by the governor and are law now, and I'll just list those as quickly as I can. Senate Bill 5055. To require the state's Public Employment Relations Commission to establish a pool of 9 to 18 arbitrators who will hear police disciplinary cases starting January 1st, 2022. Arbitrators would be assigned in alphabetical order, must have, among other skills, experience in recognizing racism and implicit bias, and will be required to complete a training program. Decisions made by the arbitrators will be posted on a public website within 30 days after the decision is made. A major police reform bill. Some other police reform bills include House Bill 1090, which which bans, actually not a police reform bill, House Bill 1090 bans private prisons and detention centers in the state of Washington, except for mental health facilities, rehab centers, juvenile, medical, and educational centers, quarantine facilities, work release facilities, residential substance abuse treatment centers, and facilities used by the U.S. Marshals Service. What this essentially does is it bans private detention centers for immigration detainees. And that's a very positive thing. House Bill 1078 will restore voting rights to people convicted of felonies once they've been released from prison. And it has been strengthened to require the Secretary of State's office to update the list of ineligible voters on a monthly basis. So folks who are released from prison will only have about a month to 2 months to wait for their names to be automatically removed from the list of ineligible voters in the state of Washington. Another very positive bill. Senate Bill 5284 ends the odious practice in which the State Department of Labor and Industries issued subminimum wage special certificates for the employment of people with disabilities. They'll be phasing that out over the next 2 years so that people with disabilities can be paid a living wage.
And not a decade too soon.
I know. Senate Bill 5106 will allow credit unions to now accept deposits from counties with populations of more than 300,000. This will allow King County and the City of Seattle to do their banking with a local credit union instead of a big Wall Street bank if they choose to do so. Another very positive bill that has become law. House Bill 1109 expands the rights of sexual assault victims, including referral to sexual assault programs and notification of the status of law enforcement investigation and prosecution into their cases. This bill was strengthened to require the Office of the Attorney General to collect status updates on rape kits collected prior to July 2015 in order to begin tackling that huge backlog, inexcusable backlog that the state has in processing rape kits. Senate Bill 5119, the State Department of Corrections and local jails will be required to convene a review team whenever an inmate dies unexpectedly. That's also become law. House Bill 1114 encourages utilities to help their customers purchase and install energy conservation equipment, especially cool roofs, and to help them with planting trees. And it allows municipal utilities to collect donations from customers for urban forestry programs. Very good bill. And then the HB 1424, the puppy mill bill, passed and was signed into law. It would prevent the sale of cats by retail pet stores, and it would prevent retail stores from selling dogs if they've never sold one in the past. So that bill was weakened to grandfather in stores that currently sell puppies. So not the strong bill that that animal rights activists had hoped for, but it's a start in ending puppy mills.
God, did the puppy mill lobbying group get in there and mess
they
with that?
They did. They got in there and they lobbied, saying, "Hey, you're going to impact our business," and some legislators fell for that. So
yeah, well, I think the whole idea is to impact your business, right?
Yes, it is. That was the idea. Cats will be banned from retail sale, but not dogs, unfortunately. So.
And when was the last time you heard of a kitty mill? It's just really hard to herd them, basically.
True. Now, bills that passed the legislature are now sitting on the governor's desk. There are many, many of them, and many of them are related to police reform. And I want to talk at least about the ones related to police reform. Those include Senate Bill 5172, House Bill 1054, which bans the use of chokeholds and neck restraints. It prohibits no-knock warrants and bans the use of many types of military equipment, including weapons that are larger than 50 caliber, armed vehicles of any type, and LRAD, but does not ban armored vehicles. And the difference might be, an example of the difference would be helicopter gunships, for example, are armed vehicles.
Oh, great.
Tanks are armed vehicles, but armored personnel carriers are not armored vehicles. They are armored vehicles, so they would still be allowed. Now, it also places restrictions on the use of tear gas, but allows it to be used for hostage situations when a suspect has barricaded him or herself and whenever there's a riot. Again, that's a subjective judgment. But law enforcement personnel will be required to exhaust all other alternatives first. And then they'll have to get the sign-off by the highest elected official in their jurisdiction, mayor if they're in a city, or a county executive if they're in an unincorporated area, before they can deploy tear gas. And I should note that pepper spray is not included in the definition of tear gas in this bill. So pepper spray is still free game. Now, the bill also forbids cops from firing on a moving vehicle unless there's an imminent danger of harm, and the bill requires police to wear legible name badges at all times. House Bill 1267 sets up an Office of Independent Investigations within the governor's office, which can investigate use of force cases starting in July 1, 2022. The new office will be required to finish each investigation within 120 days of when they open a case. That's 4 months. So that means a speedy investigation, but it may also mean that some investigations get closed without being completed. Okay. So Senate Bill 5051 expands the ability of the Criminal Justice Training Commission to decertify police officers in Washington State, particularly when they've been fired by their departments. All law enforcement agencies in the state must report disciplinary cases and separations, or, you know, firings, to the Community Justice Training Commission. All cases will be maintained on a public database. And it requires that law enforcement agencies conduct comprehensive background checks before hiring new officers. And that includes checking if that new employee is affiliated with an extremist organization by checking their social media accounts. I think a very strong bill and worth reading the whole bill, Senate Bill 5051. House Bill 1089 will require the state auditor to review investigations of deadly force by police to determine if the investigators complied with state rules. Very important bill. And it will also allow the state auditor, at the request of the Criminal Justice Training Commission, to review the training and certification of police officers by any law enforcement agency in the state, kind of strengthening the state's oversight of what law enforcement agencies are doing to comply with state law. Senate Bill 5066 will require any peace officer to intervene when he or she sees another peace officer engaging in excessive use of force. They will also be required to report the incident to the officer's supervisor. This bill also requires law enforcement personnel to render aid to victims who've been injured through police use of force as soon as it's safe to do so. They'll be required to provide some kind of medical aid. And then House Bill 1310 establishes a standard for use of deadly force by police officers. Deadly force may only be used to, quote, protect against an imminent threat of serious physical injury or death to the officer or another person. And force can only be used when another alternative doesn't exist and the force is reasonable and proportional. It also requires police to use de-escalation tactics first. Another very strong bill. House Bill 1223 requires police departments to record the audio and video of any interrogation of a juvenile or any person suspected of a felony, regardless of their age. Law enforcement agencies will be required to develop policies and procedures for preserving recorded interrogations and making them available throughout any ensuing legal case. So those are the main bills that relate to police accountability. Some really good bills didn't make it very far, but these are the ones that did, and I think it's been a very, very positive year for that.
Yeah, and you know, even assuming that Inslee signs them all, my concern is whether they will be enforced. So that's going to require continuing monitoring.
Yeah, and that's going to be probably some lawsuits filed in various jurisdictions, particularly local jurisdictions, or people complaining to the state bodies that have been formed by some of these bills to monitor local law enforcement agencies to make sure they're complying with state law now.
Oh, great. So SPD can cost Seattle taxpayers, you know, a few million dollars more.
Yeah, we'll see. Now, a couple of other great bills that passed and are sitting on the governor's desk is Senate Bill 5172, which would phase in overtime pay for agricultural workers, long overdue. Agricultural workers have long been exempt from receiving time and a half pay for any hours that they work above 40 hours per week. That's going to be phased in over about 2 to 3 years. So that's a good bill that passed and is waiting for Inslee to sign.
So what happens with agricultural workers who are paid piecework? They're not paid by the hour, they're paid by how much they pick, for example.
I don't know. And that's one that I think is, and I just don't know how often that's being done now. I think most jobs are employers are required to pay them hourly, particularly jobs that where agricultural workers are not just picking crops. I think a lot of agricultural workers do other work like pruning trees and planting.
Sure. Or food processing.
Yeah, food processing or maintenance work. I think a lot of the picking is automated these days too, and that there aren't that many crops that are being hand-picked anymore. Okay. Now, House Bill 1044 allows the Department of Corrections to put in place a college education program at state correctional facilities and provide assistance to prisoners who want to get a post-secondary degree. And it would provide special education opportunities for prisoners with learning disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and cognitive impairments. A very, very positive bill. Kind of a companion bill to that is Senate Bill 5194, which will expand access to higher education in community and technical schools by adopting a diversity, equity, and inclusion work plan to hire more guidance counselors and adopt a guided pathways program to help students finish school with a degree. It would also provide mental health counseling for students who are struggling. I think another very, very positive bill that also aligns with Biden's national program to try to expand free community and technical college education to all students. And there were many, many other great bills this year, and I can't cover them all. So if you're wondering how your bills did or you want to just kind of take a look and see what cleared the state legislature this year, you can go to the state's website at leg.wa.gov, and you can look up bills by bill number, or you can search bills by subject matter and see what bills were introduced, which ones made it through, and which ones stalled in committee or didn't get a floor vote. So,
all right.
leg.wa.gov.
Okay, so I count that we have like 6 minutes left.
I know.
So, yep.
So I just want to talk about one thing with COVID this week. There'll be more next week, I'm sure. And that is the reversion of a number of counties in Washington State on Monday to phase two rather than phase three reopening. That includes King County, Snohomish County, and Skagit County in Puget Sound, and a number of other counties. And really, this should have happened 3 weeks ago. The state revisits these phases every 3 weeks. And just before the phase announcement 3 weeks ago, Jay Inslee changed the criteria. Instead of having to meet one of two metrics in order to backslide, Inslee decided you had to meet both. Well, 3 weeks ago, King County only met one. It now meets both metrics in terms of rising case numbers, rising hospitalizations, et cetera. And, this should have happened 3 weeks ago. So please, it is not time to relax. Wear your mask outdoors. I don't care. I'm not going to talk about the CDC this week. We'll get to that next week. But there are serious caveats to the CDC's guidance about not wearing masks outdoors. Go to the CDC's website and read those and take them to heart. You can't really tell who's been vaccinated and who hasn't in terms of people who aren't wearing masks. So just assume that they haven't been vaccinated if they're not wearing a mask, and steer clear. That's all I'll say.
It's an interesting this week that the head of King County Health, or at least their lead person, posted image where he's clearly happy that he, you know, an image without him wearing a mask for the first time. I haven't seen that. And basically saying, yeah, it's been 2 weeks since I got my shot. I'm out enjoying life, you know, without the mask. This is great. And it just seemed to me, well, that's an interesting message to send as we slip into phase two.
And that person also testified before King County Council on Tuesday that the county was going to backslide. So, you know, it's very mixed messaging. And that's the big problem I have with the CDC's guidance, is it may be medically accurate, but it's terrible public messaging. Because it encourages people to relax, and it's not time to relax yet.
Well, and I think, too, saying that he got his shot in the singular ignores the fact that a lot of people are getting the two-dose regimen.
Okay, it might have been two. It might have been two shots. Well, he had a shot 2 weeks ago, so we don't know.
That's another big problem is a high number of people are getting one shot of the two-dose regimen and are not going back for the second shot.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
And that, again, has been poor public messaging, where you're getting all these studies that there's some coverage after one shot, but it's not, you know, it's not as much coverage as you get with two shots. And it doesn't last nearly as long as it does with two shots, but that's not being conveyed clearly. Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on COVID?
Let's move on. India and Brazil are awful. Actually, all of Latin America is awful. Per capita, it's even worse than India. And it's not getting attention in U.S. media.
All right. Well, something that did get some attention was Rudy Giuliani this week.
Oh, yeah. And that, again, was kind of misleading in terms of the media coverage. It's actually much more serious than the headlines would tell you. Giuliani, of course, had to know this was coming. The DOJ had petitioned for a search warrant for him apparently last year, and that was quashed by Bill Barr and his cronies. But it was granted this time. And in order to go before a judge and get the search warrant, bear in mind that not only do they have to have a pretty good idea that they'll find what they're looking for right now, one of the conditions of the search warrant is that you have to be concerned that there's a risk that the suspect will destroy evidence. You know, they had to know what they were looking for. They had to know it was there. They had to know that there was a risk that it would go away if they didn't go in there. And so they had the surprise 6 a.m. raid, as well as with a couple of Giuliani's associates. Now, the interesting thing about this, the headlines were all about, well, he didn't declare as a foreign agent because of his work in Ukraine and trying to unseat the then U.S. ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, who was an anti-corruption figure, and so Giuliani was working with corrupt pro-Russian Ukrainian politicians to try and get her out. Well, the question of legality on this is whether Giuliani got paid. And it didn't have to be paid in cash. It could have been an associate paid. It could have been something else of value, like, say, dirt on a political rival of his boss, Donald Trump, which we know happened because Giuliani harvested quite a bit of Russian disinformation that was meant to throw suspicion on Hunter Biden. And we know now that most of the sources for that were, according to U.S. intelligence, active Russian intelligence agents. We also know that Giuliani and Associates, his consulting firm, signed contracts with a number of Ukrainian politicians. So he did get money. We know that Dmitry Firtash, who's the oligarch who's now in Vienna trying to fight U.S. extradition, paid Lev Furness, who is an associate of Giuliani's, $1 million for no apparent reason. This might explain why that money came in. We also know that Giuliani tried to intervene in the Justice Department with Bill Barr to try and quash Dmitry Firtash's extradition proceedings to the United States. And sure enough, he was not extradited, at least not during the Trump administration. So there's a lot there for the Southern District to work with. It rehashes a lot of the stuff that, you know, came out in bits and drabs through investigative journalism and the investigations that went into the first Trump impeachment. And I don't blame people if it's all a blur at this point, but we're going to be hearing a lot more about those details in the coming weeks and months. And I think Giuliani is almost certainly going to be indicted. And then the question is whether the person he is working for is also going to be indicted around that whole circus. If it's strictly a legal question, probably. But we'll have to see. It becomes a political question at some point, too.
All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week.
Stay tuned.
Yep. Yes.